My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday.
Welcome to the Two Mats question and answer session brought to you by the New European.
Our regular dose of Sunday wisdom and...
Should we crack straight in?
Let's just... Go for it.
Interesting first question, given the local election results.
Tom Baldwin and Mark Steers, these were our guests on the podcast, the main podcast last week, talking about their book about England, talked of piecemeal improvements in GB-EU relations under Labour. Starmer has made no such proposition. I see no evidence for optimism. Do you? From Jonathan Fogel or Fogel. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, but thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Matt, what do you reckon?
Well, I agree with Jonathan in the sense that literally, I see no evidence for optimism, but I have optimism. Keir, as we said in Friday's podcast, you know, seems slavishly adherent to any kind of noises about, you know, sticking to the Brexit, making Brexit work, a Brexit that works, you know, a refusal to countenance youth mobility that the European Union put on the table last week.
Sectoral exemptions for immigration, which are so important to the economy, things like that, they just won't go near them.
All of this stuff. So the only rational conclusion I can reach, and rationality is a dangerous position to hold in politics these days, the only rational conclusion I reach is that they have decided pre-election they are going nowhere near anything that smells of we're rowing back on Brexit to 100%. Any degree. And it is purely an electoral position.
Yeah.
So that then raises all sorts of questions for me about integrity, duplicity, about, you know, gaming in politics, which I absolutely love.
Saying one thing and doing another.
All of this stuff, you know, and opening up a whole can of worms of accusations of betrayal from people who care very much about Brexit being as rigorously enforced as possible, you know, so more mess to come.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good way of looking at it because, of course, the problem that those of us who want to be members of the European Union again have is that Brussels will not look at any such proposition until both parties are more or less sympathetic to it.
Yeah.
And you're right. If voters go into this election thinking, you know, pro-Brexit voters thinking, well, that at least that's safe. You know, I can see the electoral argument for it, but there is a big problem thereafter because unless Labour really is going to just leave Brexit as it is, which I think would be a cause of deep despair, then they are. You're right. There's an element of false trading, isn't there?
Yeah.
And that's a big problem. I mean, all we've had really so far in terms of anything meaty is David Lammy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, told the Munich Security Conference that he was all up for a new security pact with the EU, and that's partly connected to the fact that if Trump wins in November, the EU is going to, and Europe generally, is going to have to be much better equipped to face security challenges without the help of America. So that was a kind of clear and present danger thing.
Yeah.
But on the broader thing, they're going to keep a million miles away from this. I mean, I think they've accepted that a big dividing line in the election is going to be migration because Sunak will say that Starmer is soft on migration because he's going to get rid of the Rwanda plan. And I suspect they don't want two of these. However, you know, this is the massive, you know, yellow-starred elephant in the room. And if Labour become the government, it will be even bigger.
Yeah.
Because it is the issue. It is, how do we get growth of the sort that we need to fund the public services that we need without being at the minimum in the single market? And yeah. I don't know about you, but I don't see a way of doing that.
But also, to restate the point you made just a minute ago, getting the UK government to start talking about reintegrating to elements of the EU is the easy part, actually.
Even though that's massively difficult. That's right.
The challenge is the European Union saying, do us a favour. You know, do you think we're going to sit there and be at the mercy of a disunited kingdom over Europe for the next decade or so?
Yeah.
But you guys need to be 100% on board with this before we even start talking about reintegration.
Well, Peter Mandelson was misquoted or taken out of context the other day, because he was asked about rejoining and he said, you've got to be joking. And this was taken by a lot of people as, you know, the former commissioner, EU commissioner and Europhile, saying, no way will we rejoin. But what he actually went on to say was, you know, Brussels won't listen at the moment.
Of course,
this is not on the table for Brussels at the moment. The first thing is to get Britain in a position where it can apply.
Yeah.
And he's right. I mean, he's absolutely right.
I mean, the reality is that Ukraine would be a simpler addition to the European Union than the United Kingdom.
Yes,
right
it
now.
Would. It would, because there'd be there's cross-party agreement.
Totally. That's how bad things are here.
It is. And one thing, just a final thought on this. I mean, I do think that the way the Remain-Leave argument was framed was that Remainers were soft and Leavers were hard. Okay? I mean, I massively...
Yeah.
But, you know, that was the vibe that the referendum
Liberal
created.
Progressives Liberal, versus conservative, you know, pragmatics,
you know,
blah, blah, blah,
robust, muscular.
Yeah.
But actually, I think the opposite is true, which is that I think we're heading for very hard times in some respects. And one of them is the way that the world will work. You'll have an ever more inward-looking America, a hostile Russia and a China doing all sorts of things, and Europe, understood as broadly as possible, needs to up its game and be strong, and Britain needs to be part of that, to be part of a, you know, a bloc that has security, commercial integrity. You know, this is not just about this isn't just about warm feeling.
No, if we want to be players in the
if
in
we
the
want to be players
century,
on the field, you know, this
we're
is
not going to do it on our own.
This is hard power as well as soft power, and I think that it's very important not to leave that out the argument, because you know, it's not. I mean, I do want to be part of the EU, and there is a sort of emotional dimension to it. Obviously, you know, the clue is in the surname, but you know, it's. But actually, I think there is a specific 2024 based reason why we really do need to be in the bloody EU.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Jonathan, for that question. A topic we will revisit time and time again, I am sure. So Leo from Gateshead asks, why has Leveson 2 seemingly disappeared from the radar? Well, I don't think it's not just disappeared from the radar.
It's gone.
It's been absolutely categorically wiped out by the government, hasn't it?
It was axed by Matt Hancock in 2018 when he was Culture Secretary.
Are we supposed, Leo asks, are we supposed to believe the press is properly reformed? Well, so, I think it's a good question, isn't it?
It's a good question. I mean, the answer is, of course not.
Mm.
I mean, think about this a lot recently, actually. And I think that, I mean, clearly the Leveson process was unfinished. The part two was meant to look at the relationship between the press and the police.
Yes.
And that's now apparently not going to be explored, which is not good. The regulatory system in press and IPSO, the two rival systems, is not desirable. And we know that the regulatory structure isn't working. But I also think that we need a kind of holistic look at how media works.
That's exactly right.
That includes social media as well as print media.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is a very, very old school thing to say, but I almost wonder if this is a good moment for a royal commission
yeah.
on media and I it's, and information, you know. But I mean, and I don't just mean run by a 150-year-old judge. I mean staffed by people who really know about media in all its forms, yeah. digital, print, and so on, and understand how information works and disinformation works yeah. and bias works and impartiality yeah. works. Because, you know, Ofcom is not regulating social media at all.
No.
We often have cause on the podcast to discuss the, you know, the role of the sort of right-wing press and how yeah. it gets away with murder. It's the system is not working. We desperately need better regulatory structures and cultural norms mm. around media. And I think that it would be great to have something that was not just an inquiry into a specific wrongdoing, but an inquiry into where we are now.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm not sure it ever was actually the point of Leveson, but if the point of Leveson was to in some way fundamentally change how the press and media operates, it failed 100%, because apart from the press going through this period of huge payouts to victims yes. of phone hacking, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed.
No, I mean, it was a bit like after, do you remember after Diana was killed?
Yeah. Or died, we should say.
Yeah.
She wasn't killed, was she?
Well, killed in a car crash, but I yeah, realised it yeah. came out like I was saying
she was bumped off.
MI6 and Prince yeah. Philip. No, just yeah. to be clear. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, after that, there was this brief period of reticence, wasn't there, where yeah. the Paps behaved themselves a little bit and yeah. Long Lens users behaved themselves a little bit. And then we were back in business before yeah. you could say knife. So, yeah.
But, and we should mention briefly Prospect Magazine's investigation.
Yeah. Nick Davis has done a
really good investigation into potential commercial criminality
yes.
around phone hacking from News UK, where the allegation is that they hacked the phones of government ministers to try and find out how their various deals were going on. And also the enormous scale of email deletion led by Rebecca Brooks and also Will Lewis, who is
now Supremo of the Washington
Supremo
Post.
Of the Washington Post. You know, so there is still you still now both those people are still at the top of the pyramid in media. So, you know, a commission that would look at the networks
and everything
and the way that everything works and the vested interests and just put everything out on the table so that people could understand. You know, I think by and large, people think that, you know, everyone's a bit biased, but everyone's basically straight. Well, that's not the case. You know, and the reason that nothing changes is that they're all mates. You know, and they've all got this network of vested interest. And that's what's got to be challenged, I think. And I can't really think of anything that trumps that in terms of importance for a society.
No.
In the information that you take.
100%. I mean, we talk a lot on the pod about ultra-processed food and nutrition. And I rather think that information
totally
needs to be regulated and labelled
yeah.
like food.
Yeah.
You know, and kids need to be taught
yeah.
in a way that probably we didn't, actually.
Yeah.
You know, because frankly, for us, there was the local paper and then the papers and then a few TV stations and radio stations. And that was it. Right. Mm-hmm. And now kids have literally a million sources of information coming at them every day through their devices. And that's yeah. going to become more complicated with AI.
Yeah.
And I think that teaching kids and indeed adults about how to understand and be cautious of these sources, you know, both for bias in newspapers, but also outright falsehood coming yeah. at you,
yeah.
you know, down your phone.
Yeah.
These are, you know, this is critical. You know, if you want, there's a lot of talk at the moment about the big battle between authoritarianism and democracy. Well, it starts here.
Absolutely
it really
right.
does.
Absolutely right. Thank you, Leo. Great question. Next question, please.
How worried should we be by Trump's second term plans set out in his cover piece interview for Time, Julia in Brixton?
Well, absolutely fucking terrified in a
There's
sentence.
No other word for yeah. it.
I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary. As I read the piece,
it's amazing, isn't it?
It kept getting worse and worse and
you
worse.
Do you think it's I mean,
he's talking about concentration camps yeah. basically.
Yeah.
And he's talking about the insurrectionists as patriotic heroes.
I mean,
it's incredible.
There's people have objected. I mean, there's been a very strong reaction to this interview piece. It was a cover piece in Time, and of course it's, you know, when you think about what, well, why did he agree to do it, you only have to think about 1980s Trump, when Time was one of the big media forces in the world, and being on the cover of Time.
And the cover, we should say.
He's the cover piece.
Is it, you know, like...
Makes him regal. And...
It makes him... It's like an amazing portrait of him.
Yes.
Do you know what it reminded me of? Bizarrely.
What's that?
It reminded me of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington.
That's very good. Yes, with it, the...
He, where Lincoln sat on this big kind of presidential... chair, throne kind
of
thing.
The man who invented the Republican Party and the man who destroyed it.
Well, and Trump, it's not quite the same, but it has that
no, you're
air
right,
about
you're
it.
Right, there's, you know? There's an echo.
Yeah.
I mean, look, there are some things in it which he hasn't, which he has said before, but so what? Because the fact that he said them all in one after the other to an interviewer at Mar-a-Lago and then on the phone shows that he means it.
Yeah,
this is the thing I think really, really matters, is that because he's funny and because he's absurd and vulgar and awful, people often think that even after what everything that happened in the first term on January the 6th, that he didn't really mean it. You know, he does mean it.
Yeah.
And this time he really means it. And he makes the point in the interview that he is going to be sure that this time he's surrounded by loyalists.
Yeah, acolytes.
I mean, and there are some, I mean, there are... You know, he goes on about the massive deportation program for undocumented.
He's talking about 11 million people.
11 million people. Yeah. And these are not people who are on the border. These are people who are embedded in their communities and their families. And then he says he would use the military. And the interviewer quite rightly quotes posse comitatus, which is an act in American law, which... you know, basically forbids the use of military force on civilians. And Trump brushes it away and says, well, you know, so what?
Mm.
I mean, but there are lots of things in it which are deeply troubling. I mean, from he's apparently relaxed about the individual states monitoring women's pregnancies.
This is so extraordinary.
So they're not breaking the individual state laws on abortion.
It's like Margaret Atwood stuff, isn't
it? I mean, that's intrusion on a level that, you know, would amaze the Soviet bloc, you know, in the Cold War. I mean, that is medical intrusion of individuals. And then he throws away lines like considering a tariff of more than the 10% on all imports. Well, first of all, what happened to free trade Republicans? And secondly, that is a massively inflationary... I mean, if you put 10% on all products, you will have an inflationary crisis.
Yeah.
So... the pulling troops out of South Korea, you know, only hiring people who agree that he won the 2020 election.
Yeah, extreme. 1984.
And then the killer line for me, and, you know, not a surprise, I suppose, but still shocking. He's asked about the prospect of political violence around the election, and Trump says, if we don't win, you know, it depends. It always depends on the fairness of the election, which is as clear to as you can get to. Well, if I don't win, expect January the 6th on steroids, folks.
Well, this is what I thought was the most extraordinary line, or the one that maybe he said it before, but I hadn't read it quite so bluntly, where he said, no, these guys were patriots and I'm going to pardon them all.
Yeah.
And they were, I call them the J6.
The hostages.
What do you call them? The J6 patriots.
J6 hostages.
Right. I mean, it's my question was that, you know, this guy's under investigation, facing trials of being an insurrectionist.
Election
insurrectionist. And here he is saying that the guys who were literally defiling the Capitol.
And by the way, led
are heroes.
To, and five people died as a consequence of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone acts on the MAGA side.
Like it was just a riot. Yeah.
Well, or, you know, it was just some of them, people just describe it as a walk around. It wasn't. It was a riot and people died.
Yeah.
He is planning to pardon all these people.
Yeah.
And, you know, at all of his rallies, and indeed at the dinner that's described in the Time piece, he plays the J6 choir, I believe it's called.
Jeez.
Which is these guys that are in prison singing the Star Spangled Banner.
Right.
And everyone at the dinner apparently stood to their feet.
Isn't this evidence, though, that he is an insurrectionist?
Yes. It's not just evidence that he was an insurrectionist in January 2020.
But he is now.
It's evidence that he is by temperament an insurrectionist.
Yes.
That really for him, elections are... I mean, as for Putin, elections are only useful if they provide the right result.
Yeah.
You know, elections are really just performative referendums.
Do you know the mistake we all make is that we try and rationalise these people on our terms, and we try and sort of, we create escape clauses and mitigations and stuff like this.
Believe it.
He's a bad guy.
He's a bad guy, and he represents a significant drift in American political culture, which I personally regard as a tragedy, from the spirit of the founding fathers, who for all their flaws did create a beautiful document in the Constitution and then the subsequent amendments. And it, you know, we all know that America has a one of the great scars in modern history in slavery.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, you know, there was an experiment in America which was continuing, and Trump has just stood across that and said, actually, I think America should be an autocracy, a Peronist or Orbanite or Putinite autocracy. And this election, it's for real.
Yeah,
it really is.
It is.
And I thought that the Time, which is not a magazine I often pick up, but I did, because you know, some people have been quite snarky about it, because the interviewer was reasonably, you know, it just provided the words, which I actually thought was a good way to do it.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's an important interview. Everyone should read it. Maybe we should put the link in the show notes,
Yeah, let's do that. And Julia, to answer your question directly, how worried should we be?
Very.
The answer is a lot.
I'm afraid so.
This podcast, The Two Mats, is sponsored as ever by the New European Newspaper. And we've got a very special subscription offer for you, a new one, where you can get a free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover. That's right, you heard that right, folks. It's a absolutely top quality burgundy, like vegan leather, beautifully designed passport cover.
Pleather.
To have pleather, that's what they call it, isn't it? Pleather. To hide your new British blue.
The shame of the blue passport.
And you can get your free Bollocks to Brexit passport cover free, and it's worth £25, by the way, free with a subscription to the New European from just £1 a week. And for £1 a week, you get all of our digital content, including the new app, which we've just spent an absolute fortune redesigning and is really, really superb now. And
the least you can do is subscribe.
The least you can do is help us pay for that. Or for an extra £1 a week, if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door, which I do very much.
Me too.
Every week, we will send you first class post, our award-winning newspaper, The New European, and that will be a saving of more than 75% on the retail price. So to take this fantastic offer, and trust me, if you like this podcast, you will absolutely love The New European, go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats. That's the number 2, M-A-T-T-S, and there's a link in the show notes.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Next question, please.
Are American university students right to hold campuses hostage over something they believe in so passionately? Good question. Jenny883 on Spotify.
Well, I think My answer is no, they're not. But I'm really torn on it. I think the violence that is now echoing the stone that had been thrown into the pond with the Hamas atrocity.
Yeah,
this it's is amazing. This isn't is it? One How of the ripples that is echoed is, out, and they are all similar in nature to that. In that they all contain genuine violence, and it's a great, great shame. But I've got to be honest, I'm becoming much more sympathetic the longer this goes on now in Palestine, in Gaza. And I don't think that students should hold, well, the use of the word hostage is interesting, isn't it?
Well, I think that's kind of the word in the question that I would interrogate a bit, mm-hmm. which is that, you know, I mean, and as you know, I've sort of been, you know, a bit more on the Israel, you know, I've been sympathetic to some of the Israel policy, but free speech and free assembly matters to me hugely.
Yeah.
So that was why when the marchers in London wanted to march on Armistice Day, I thought they should be able to.
Yeah.
Because I think it's really important. Mm-hmm. And campus sit-ins and, you know, demonstrations, especially in America, have a quite, I would almost say, a glorious history. You know, they've been part of American culture. Mm-hmm. And so my initial feeling was, look, it doesn't matter whether I agree with them or not. They, you know, they have something to say. Their generation feels really strongly about Gaza. It's their Vietnam. Okay. Mm-hmm. And as long as they don't threaten violence, and as long as they don't stop people getting to class.
Yeah.
Have at it, you know. I mean, I to be honest, I sort of think that that's part of what university's about.
Or, yeah.
But it doesn't have to be universities. But in America, it seems to be. Yeah, you know, in this country, we take to the streets. In America, they seem to do it on campuses. I don't know why that's the case. But it has become. You're right. I mean, it's become horribly ugly very quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, we've both got kids. No one wants to see kids, however stupid they are, being beaten with batons and having tear gas blown at them and rubber bullets shot at them.
And also getting criminal records. Getting
criminal records
and
stuff like that. I mean, so I am, you know, there is part of me that thinks, was there no other way of policing these encampments?
I've also heard students, though, saying it shouldn't have been like this. A lot of commentary from students engaged in the
saying that
saying with regret, saying it's gone too far.
It's gone too far. Yeah. So. I mean, I think that is right. And when you see some of the spokespeople for the students, the level of entitlement, and a sort of absurdity of demands, is ridiculous. And it doesn't speak well, because actually, you know, they have a perfectly valid point. They want their universities to divest from Israel, okay, which is a perfectly legitimate request. And university authorities should meet them and discuss it, and it's a good discussion.
And I'm sure the university authorities would say we'd be more than happy to do
and
so.
And indeed they are. Yeah. But you know, then you see that that they are going after people who are carrying the American flag.
Yeah.
Now that's weird, right? Because, you know, the American flag in America has a much deeper significance than the Union Jack has here, actually. You know, people have it everywhere. You know, it's And so making campuses sort of no-go areas for the Stars and Stripes is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I think this is a real crisis, and Biden really didn't answer it by saying, I believe in free speech and I believe in the rule of law, because actually, this is one of those moments where you kind of have
one
to
of them's
choose.
Got to give a bit. Yeah, yeah.
And I think where we're heading, and this is why Democrats are so neuralgic about it, is that this is looking so like 1968, where Vietnam was coming to a very bloody head, and America was hugely politicized about it, especially the younger generation. And the Chicago Democrat convention was surrounded by violence and riots and so on. Norman Mailer's brilliant book about the two conventions of that year, Miami and Chicago, is fantastic on that. And wouldn't you know it, where is the Democratic convention being held in August? Chicago.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of folkloric memory at the very apex of the Democrat memory, which is, we have got to stop this now. But I think if you look at Biden's electoral coalition and its dependency upon young voters coming out, and they're not high propensity voters, they don't come out. They did in 2020. They did. This is not going to help, because the young Democratic demographic already hate Biden for Gaza.
Yeah, yeah.
And if they see this, which they will be,
yeah,
they'll probably stay at home, actually.
Yeah, they're not going to come out for Trump, I don't think.
They're not going to come out for... Some will come out for Robert Kennedy Jr., bizarrely, because he mysteriously polls very well with the young. I suppose because of the glamour of the name, I don't know.
Yeah.
But this is... In such a tightly geared election, this is now going to be a factor, not necessarily a determining factor, but never forget, Trump, part of Trump's thing is order.
Yeah, yeah.
Not law and order, order.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I think Kennedy polls well with the young because he's been on Rogan so often.
He understands what they call podcastistan in America.
Do they?
Which is long form. He's been on Shapiro, he's been on Bill Maher.
Yeah.
He's been on Lex Fridman, I think. He's really eschewed the mainstream media and gone on all these podcasts.
Like a Jordan Peterson substitute, isn't he?
He is, and it's a funny thing, and we should look into it sometime. We don't really do 3-hour podcasts in this country, but in America, they've got loads of them. And he's happy to sit down for 3 hours with Joe Rogan and talk about everything from, the last one he did, he said that Robert Kennedy Jr. said that Wi-Fi gives you cancer, which it really doesn't, but he'll say it. But the thing about that is, you can say anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You can say anything.
If we do 3 hours, we're going to have to get this bloody air conditioning fixed. We're melting in here.
That is the only thing standing between us and the 3-hour Rogan format.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions.
Go on. What are your thoughts on the art of interviewing nowadays? I feel they are too negative, too devil's advocate, and depend on the viewer doing their own post-interview research, which nobody is doing. Josh Dyett on Spotify. Thanks, Josh.
And this was also a very similar question was asked by Roy Pierce, so thank you.
Which suggests it's on people's minds.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. What do you think?
I think I would first of all jump to the defence of some interviews who I think are really good. I thought, for example, last week, Nick Robinson on the Today programme and Lee Anderson was a really good good interview. Yeah. And I think, Robert Peston's a good interviewer. Yeah. And I think Andrew
Michelle Hussain. She's had a fantastic few weeks.
And Laura Koonsberg, though she gets a lot of flack, I still think an excellent interviewer.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. And Trevor Phillips on Sky.
I like Amol Rajan.
Very good. I'm not sure that it's a failure of tradecraft, I think, or individuals. I think that the problem, and Josh sort of hints at it, is that interviewing used to be not relaxed, that's wrong, but if you go back to the Robin Day, Brian Walden era, it was a genuine dialogue.
Yeah.
I've got somewhere in my sad, huge political book collection, which is makes me the party guy that I am. I've got a collection of Brian Walden's interviews. And they're unrecognisable compared to today because, he'll ask Nigel Lawson or Neil Kinnock a question and they'll answer it in paragraphs.
Yes.
Now, interviewing is done for clipping on social media. So you'll listen to an interview and they'll say the same thing 15 times so that the bit that's clipped and put on YouTube and Spotify and X and so on includes the point they're trying to get across.
Yeah.
And so really interviews are just sort of, and this is very, very frustrating if you're doing an interview, and I know this from having done them, you know, you're trying to get them to say something and they just say the same thing 10 times. I mean, often the best thing to do, and you can do this in a written interview, which you can't really on air, is just to let them talk.
This is the point I was going to make. Like, so the Today programme, for instance, which I know we both listen to, and sometimes they knock it out of the park, mm-hmm. and sometimes you're just sitting there thinking, well, for 15 minutes, you've let somebody just say the same thing over and over and again, regardless of how you've tried to counter it. And 15 minutes isn't long enough. That's the point. So say maybe they're just trying to do too much. You know, maybe they're trying to get too many magazine-y bits in between what's really important. And maybe they should say, well, instead of that 15, 20-minute section at 10 past 8, we'll do it for 40 minutes. You know, and the sport will have to give or something like this. But we'll sit down and we'll have somebody talking properly for a longer time. The whole dynamic of the show should change. But again, I assume they're doing what they're doing because of feedback and polling and
maybe,
surveys and stuff.
Maybe, but, you know, again, to go back to the American example, I mean, you know, the audience for these three-hour interviews, podcasts in America, is pretty skewed young.
Yeah.
So the perennial argument, which is you can't have an interview that lasts more than 10 minutes on the Today programme, people will switch off. Would they? I mean, what actually is intrinsically wrong with having 30 minutes? I mean, Richard Holden on the Tory chair on Thursday squirmed for 10 minutes under interrogation. But actually, what you really wanted was for a proper longer form analysis of, well, you know, what does this mean?
The other problem though, Matt, is that they've got so many different platforms now.
Yes.
So true. You know, in the old days of the old, you know, when we were listening to Radio 4 in, you know, the 70s and 80s.
The home service.
That was it. You know, that was, they weren't rushing off to Sky.
No, that's right.
They weren't. GMB.
There wasn't a car waiting
LBC,
outside to take them off to.
Talk radio.
Yes,
you know,
yeah.
They've now got to do 15 minutes everywhere.
The media round.
You know, so there's too much of it, unfortunately.
There is. And it ends up meaning nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, I do mourn the passing of just sit down interviews.
Yeah.
And then and those that exist, like Hard Talk,
yeah,
are sort of marginalized in,
that's right.
in, you know, they're pushed off into you know, sub channels.
Was Paxman a you know, looking back in hindsight, was he a good interviewer or
yeah, he was. I mean, what the problem was, everyone tried to be Paxman.
Right.
You know, you want one Jeremy Paxman, not 25, you know.
Yeah.
He was really good at the kind of arched eyebrow, you're lying to me, you know.
Yeah.
And no one did it better.
Yeah.
But then everyone tried to be it.
Yeah.
You know, everyone has a different style. I mean, I think what makes Andrew Neil such a good interviewer is he is so well prepared.
Yeah.
That he has this kind of, people will say something and then he'll just come back.
Someone told me once that he's the only one that doesn't have any real researchers working.
Yeah,
for
no,
him.
He does his
it
own, all.
He knows it himself.
He's, I mean, he is immaculately forensic.
Yeah,
and that's something that's worth.
That's formidable. Yeah,
following, but you know, and other interviewers are very good at kind of just calming an interviewee into making the mistake of telling the truth.
Well, the greatest example of that in recent history is Emily Maitlis and Prince Andrew. You know, we're just kind of
superb interview,
absolutely magnificent.
Just played it straight. You know, didn't register any real shock.
I also thought Laura Koonsberg with Michelle Moan and Doug Barrowman played the same game very, very well. You know?
I mean, Laura Kay is a seriously brilliant interviewer. In
she's a class act. Yeah.
She really is.
Yeah, and you know that because all the tosses on X give her so much stick.
Oh, this line that she's a Tory stooge is just nonsense.
Yeah. All right. Well, Josh and Peter, thank you for your questions. One more quick one, I think.
Okay. Oh, no, right, okay. Sorry, Matt K, but you're a bit awry, re the proms. The flag waving is only the last night. The rest of the season is a serious world-class music festival. Happy to offer some recommendations, Roger K.
I got, and thank you, did you get, did you I got get, loads did you
get
of kick, this.
Did you get it?
I got a lot of kicking for saying I don't, and I still don't like the last night of the proms.
All right, so we're now, we are.
For clarity.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was the last night of the proms I was referring to. And I do actually really enjoy classical music. And,
yeah, I know you do. So I was interested. Yeah, because in fact, the for the rest of the time, I mean, I usually go to two or three, and it's really good. I've never been to the last night.
I just don't think the Albert Hall's a great venue acoustically. I think I'd much prefer the Barbican.
This is a very different kind of conversation.
I'm just trying to establish my classical music.
I know you know a lot about it, and I agree with you. I think it's not, you know, the acoustics are not as good, but the proms themselves are a great thing, and it's cheap as chips to go, which is good.
Yes,
because classical music is way overpriced.
Yeah, and especially opera.
Opera, which is something I love, and I've tried in my own.
I know they'll
way
to
kind of keep prices down. And
well, you know. I know they'll tell you that you can get a ticket for £13, but I've had those tickets, and they're an arduous.
Yeah, experience. I mean the only thing I would say, I mean, so I declare an interest. I'm on one of the councils of the English National Opera, and we do offer 10 tickets, which are quite good, you know. But you're right. I mean, I was looking at the Royal Opera House catalogue, and you know, it's £250 and £350, and that level of pricing moves a glorious art form, which is actually the heavy metal of its time. And people act as if opera is the most sophisticated form of classical music, and in some respects it is, but really it's a hedonistic form.
Well, Puccini, you know, was like absolutely, he was like the David Bowie.
And Wagner is just CGI before it was invented. I mean, that's what it is. So I love the proms because it does make it available. Yeah. I think, you know, your original point was a good one, because the last night has now become a kind of thing that people, it's become part of culture wars. You remember when there was an intervention that the Land of Hope and Glory would be sung, and it's sort of like, you know, everyone thinks of the proms as that moment.
And also it's become the battle of the Union Jack versus the European Union flag as well, hasn't it?
You know, right. Yeah. I mean, you know, I personally don't go to concerts to wave flags. I'm funny that way.
Yeah.
But
I think that's what I was trying to say, is I'm allergic to flag waving.
Yeah, I mean, and if people want to sing Jerusalem, that's fine by me. Yeah. But there's just something sort of slightly demented about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is different, which is curiously different to people on the terraces singing Three Lions.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not the same, is it?
It's, well, I've always thought that that's analogous to a hymn, the Three Lions, or You'll Never Walk Alone, or.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it.
Whatever. But there's nothing sort of spiritual about the way that they.
Well, it's the bouncing. Do you know what it.
Yes,
it's the bouncing.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's the pogoing that I can't.
Yeah, yeah.
The pogoing finishes me off. These sort of, you know, cummerbund wearing wankers pogoing up.
Now you've entirely lost.
Pogoing up and down, singing "Land of Hope and Glory."
Yeah,
just makes me want to emigrate.
I do like it. I do like when you see like a German flag there, or a French or an Italian flag in there. I think
it's nice.
You know, it's kind of like Great Britain bringing people together. Blah blah.
Yes,
blah.
But that's not. I mean, but unfortunately, that is absolutely not why people go.
No, that's right.
They go because what they really want is for the empire still to exist.
Well, I look forward to our mailbag next week now.
Yes.
Thank you, Roger K, and everybody else who pulled me up about my my proms comment in the other week. That is the
end of the show. You misspoke.
Did I misspeak?
I think that's the, as your spin doctor, I think that's the.
For my misspoken words. All right. Sorry about that. Anyway, join us next Friday for another of our regular podcasts. Don't forget your subscription offer, and you can go to theneweuropean.co.uk/2MATTS, the number 2 MATTS. There's a easy link in the show notes. Fire in any feedback and any questions you've got to us at
to matt@tnepublishing.com. And thank you to our friends at Rethink Audio for producing, Matt Hill and Ollie Peart. Until Friday.
Have a good Sunday.
Have a great Sunday, guys.
Cheers.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run FutureTools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of Lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.